Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during this show. I always start with some debt-related news and facts that are current for the week. From Bloomberg, Wall Street bonuses show we still have a problem, Obama aide Elizabeth Warren says. Wall Street banks reaping profits and paying bonuses while the rest of the country struggles shows we still have a problem with economic disparity, said Elizabeth Warren, the Obama administration advisor responsible for setting up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This just staggers me. I mean, I just don't have words to describe what this means, she said in an interview for Bloomberg Television's Conversations with Judy Woodruff. For me, what an economic recovery is about is what happens to American families. It's what happens in the real economy. It's whether or not families are building up wealth in their homes or whether or not their homes are dragging them over an economic cliff. It isn't meaningful to talk about profits in a growing economy until American families are stabilized, she said. Warren, a Harvard Law professor, was appointed in September as an advisor to President Barack Obama and the U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner to help set up the Consumer Bureau created by the Dodd-Frank Financial Regulation Overhaul enacted in July. The Bureau, which will have power to impose rules on mortgages, credit cards, and layaway plans, was proposed by Obama after lawmakers said existing regulators failed to protect borrowers against lending practices blamed for fueling the credit crisis. Warren said financial companies could benefit from new mortgage regulations that would allow them to abandon the lengthy disclosure forms now required under two housing finance laws. The Truth in Lending Act and the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act require mortgage companies to give extensive information to borrowers, but do little for either consumers or lenders, she said. What if we dump both of those forms and in its place we have a one-page mortgage shopping sheet that gives the consumers the key information that the consumer needs? They overlap by about 80% in terms of content, but because they use different terms, they have to be calculated in different ways, so they're costly for the banks to fill out. On credit cards, Warren said her team is getting creative new ideas about how to formulate credit card disclosure rules that will clarify costs and enable borrowers to do comparison shopping. A simple label for credit cards, similar to Food and Drug Administration mandated nutritional information, is one possible model for credit cards, she said. We're getting good ideas from all sorts of places, Warren said. I like the food labeling idea as at least one to take a look at, and we're getting more. Republican lawmakers who opposed creation of the Consumer Bureau and Warren's appointment to help organize it have said they will increase scrutiny and attempt to implement congressional control over the agency's funding, which Dodd-Frank stipulated would come from the Federal Reserve. We're trying to build an agency here, and we're trying to do it on behalf of the American people, Warren said. We didn't get this agency because there was $100 million of lobbying money in favor of it. In fact, the lobbying money, the big dollars, were against this agency. We got this agency because the American people want it and they want a voice in Washington, she said. And that's what I'm here to do. And that's from Bloomberg. Now I'd like to jump into what we started in the last show, the web of debt, the shocking truth about our money system and how we can break free, by Ellen Hodgson Brown, who is an attorney and who has written many books and lectured extensively on the issues that we will be bringing up in a lengthy discourse on the birth of debt problems in the United States. To get started, I like to give an important credit, as the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Ellen Brown. And I highly recommend that you read the book, The Web of Debt. So continuing where I left off during the last show, today the Federal Reserve notes and U.S. dollar loans dominate the economy of the world, but this international currency is not money issued by the American people or their government. And that's really the key main point throughout this whole book and our study here. And this is really contrary to what most people think and frankly take for granted how the government financial system works. What it really is money created and lent by a private cartel of international bankers. And this cartel has the United States itself hopelessly entangled in the web of debt. By 2006, combined personal, corporate, and federal debt in the United States had reached a staggering $44 trillion, four times the collective national income, or $147,312 for every man, woman, and child in the country. To put it bluntly, the United States is legally bankrupt, defined in the dictionary as being unable to pay one's debts, being insolvent, or having liabilities in excess of a reasonable market value of assets held. And this is particularly meaningful to myself as a bankruptcy lawyer, where clients are often feeling maligned because they need to file consumer bankruptcy with its attendant stigma of having filed bankruptcy. Yet, in truth, we frankly are all bankrupt as citizens of a bankrupt nation. By September 2008, the debt of the U.S. government had hit a breathtaking $10 trillion. Local, state, and national governments are also heavily in debt that they have been forced to sell off public assets to satisfy creditors. Crowded schools, crowded roads, and cutbacks in public transportation are eroding the quality of American life. And that's really the key thing. It's not just the flow of money as the end-all and be-all of our country. Profit is, in a sense, the god. It's the quality of life of Americans and how it's been affected by the obsession with profits. A 2005 report by the American Society of Civil Engineers gave the nation's infrastructure an overall grade of D, including its roads, bridges, drinking water systems, and other public works. Americans are spending more time stuck in traffic and less time at home with their families, said the group's president. We need to establish a comprehensive long-term infrastructure plan. We need to, but we can't, because government, at least at every level, is broke. Now, if governments everywhere are in debt, who are they in debt to? And that's what the main point of our investigation will disclose. Well, simply put, the answer is that they are in debt to private banks. The cruel hoax is that governments are in debt for money created on a computer screen, money that they could have created themselves. And I'll get back to that in a few seconds. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. One of the real fascinating things about this book, The Web of Debt, is that there is a lot of allusion from The Wizard of Oz, and the author actually will bring out some very fascinating points for all of us as kids who loved The Wizard of Oz, but never realized what it was all about. Now, the vast power acquired through the sleight of hand, in other words, why the governments are in debt to private banks for money created on a computer screen, money that the government itself could have created but didn't, is really like The Wizard of Oz. The sleight of hand is by a small clique of men pulling the strings of government behind the scenes, which does invoke those images from The Wizard of Oz, which is a classic American fairy tale that has become a rich source of imagery for financial commentators. In 2002, in an article, Who Controls the Federal Reserve System?, Victor Thorne wrote, quote, "In essence, money has become nothing more than illusion, an electronic figure or amount on a computer screen. As time goes on, we have an increasing tendency toward being sucked into the Wizard of Oz vortex of unreality by magician priests that use the illusion of money as their control device." End of the quote. Another quote by Christopher Mark. He wrote in a series called The Grand Deception, "Welcome to the world of the international banker who, like the famous film The Wizard of Oz, stands behind the curtain of orchestrated national and international policymakers and so-called elected leaders." Continuing on, the late Murray Rothbard, an economist of the classical Austrian school, wrote, "Money and banking have been made to appear as mysterious and arcane processes that must be guided and operated by a technocratic elite. They are nothing of the sort. In money, even more than the rest of our affairs, we have been tricked by a malignant Wizard of Oz." And a final quote by James Galbraith in The New American Prospect. He said, "We are left with the thought that the Federal Reserve Board does not know what it is doing. This is the Wizard of Oz theory, in which we pull away the curtains only to find an old man with a wrinkled face playing with lights and loud speakers." Now, many of us, when we step back and actually reflect on what we're hearing, what we're seeing, what we're experiencing with respect to the economy, have some intuitive sense that all of this is probably more true than what we're hearing. But somehow we've all been forced into a closet and don't recognize what's going on in the other closets around us, nor the fact that the closets are really in some grand edifice that we've lost access to. And that's a very important thought. The analogies to The Wizard of Oz work for a reason. According to later commentators, the tale was actually written as a monetary allegory at a time when the money question was a key issue in American politics. And I'm sure that Judy Garland did not know that. In the 1890s, politicians were still hotly debating who should create the nation's money and what it should consist of. Should it be created by the government with full accountability to the people? Or should it be created by private banks behind closed doors for the bank's own private ends? Who of us knew while we were studying in school as kids that the government really wasn't in control of all of this monetary system during our lives? Going back to the 1890s and the turn of the century for the 20th century, William Jennings Bryan, the populist candidate for president in 1896 and again in 1900, mounted the really last serious challenge to the right of private bankers to create the national money supply. According to commentators, Brine was represented in Frank Baum's 1900 book, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, by the Cowardly Lion. The lion finally proved he was king of the beasts by decapitating a giant spider that was terrorizing everyone in the forest. That's the book version, not the movie version. The giant spider Byron challenged at the turn of the 20th century was the Morgan Rockefeller banking cartel, which was bent on usurping the power to create money from the people and their representative government, the United States. Before World War I, two opposing systems of political economy competed for dominance in the United States. One operated out of Wall Street, New York, the financial district that came to be the symbol of American finance. Its most important address was 23 Wall Street, known as the House of Morgan. J.P. Morgan was an agent of powerful British banking interests. The Wizards of Wall Street and the Old World bankers, pulling their strings, sought to establish a national currency that was based on the gold standard, one created privately by the financial elite who, guess what, controlled the gold. Now, the other system was much older. It dated back to Benjamin Franklin and operated out of Philadelphia, the country's first capital, where the Constitutional Convention was held and Franklin's Society for Political Inquiries planned the industrialization and public works that would free the new republic from economic slavery to England. The Philadelphia faction favored a bank on the model established in provincial Pennsylvania, where a state loan office issued and lent money, collected the interest, and returned it to the provincial government to be used, and underline this one, in the place of taxes. Another great man, President Abraham Lincoln, returned to the colonial system of government-issued money during the Civil War, but he was assassinated, and the bankers reclaimed control of the money machine. The silent coup of the Wall Street faction culminated with the passage of the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, something they achieved by misleading Bryan and other unwary congressmen into thinking the Federal Reserve was actually federal. It's not. And we'll get more into this as I go through the book. This is mostly just by way of overview and introduction. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I am speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's fast forward to today. Today, the debate over who should create the national money supply is rarely heard, mainly because few people even realize it is an issue. Politicians and economists, along with everybody else, simply assume that money is created by the government, and the inflation that everybody complains about is caused by an out-of-control government running the dollar printing presses. The puppeteers working the money machine were more visible in the 1890s than they are today, largely because they had not yet succeeded in buying up the media and cornering public opinion. Generally, economics is a dry and forbidding subject that has been made intentionally complex by banking interests intent on concealing what is really going on. It is a subject that sorely needs lightening up with imagery, metaphors, characters, and a plot. So before we get into the details of the modern system of money based on debt, we'll take a little bit of an excursion back to a simpler time when the money issues were more obvious and were still a burning topic of discussion. The plot line for The Wizard of Oz has been traced to the first ever march on Washington, led by an obscure Ohio businessman who sought to persuade Congress to return to Lincoln's system of government-issued money in 1894. Besides sparking a century of protest marches and the country's most famous fairy tale, The Wizard of Oz, this little-known visionary and the band of unemployed men he led may actually have had the solution to the whole money problem, then and now. So we'll head into the first major section of the Web of Debt, the Yellow Brick Road, from gold to Federal Reserve notes. And from The Wizard of Oz, the 1939 film, Dorothy was asked, "Did you bring your broomstick?" "No, I'm afraid I didn't." "Then you'll have to walk. It's always best to start at the beginning. All you do is follow the Yellow Brick Road." That's where we'll start, with lessons from The Wizard of Oz. Remember, the great Oz has spoken. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. I am the great and powerful Wizard of Oz. In refreshing contrast to the really impenetrable writings of economists, the classic fairy tale The Wizard of Oz has delighted young and old for over a century. It was first published by L. Frank Baum as The Wonderful Wizard of Oz in the year 1900. As we all know, in 1939 it was made into a hit Hollywood movie starring Judy Garland, and later it was made into the popular stage play The Wiz. Few of the millions of us who have enjoyed this very charming tale have suspected that its imagery was drawn from the most obscure and tedious of subjects, banking and finance. Fewer still have suspected that the real-life folk heroes who inspired its plot may actually have had the answer to the financial crisis facing America today. The economic illusions in Baum's tale were first observed in 1964 by a schoolteacher named Henry Littlefield, who called the story a parable on populism, referring to the People's Party movement challenging the banking monopoly in the late 19th century. Other analysts later picked up the theme. Economist Hugh Rockoff, writing in the Journal of Political Economy in 1990, called the tale a monetary allegory. Professor Tim Ziaukas, writing in 1998, stated, "The Wizard of Oz was written at a time when American society was consumed by the debate over the financial question, that is, the creation and circulation of money. The characters of The Wizard of Oz represented those deeply involved in the debate, the Scarecrow as the farmers, the Tin Woodman as the industrial workers, the Lion as silver advocate William Jennings Bryan, and Dorothy as the archetypical American girl. The Wizard of Oz has been called the first truly American fairy tale. If we remember, the Germans established the national fairy tale tradition with Grimm's Fairy Tales, a collection of popular folklore gathered by the brothers Grimm specifically to reflect German populist traditions and national values. Baum's book did the same thing for the American populist or people's tradition. It was all about people power, manifesting your dreams, finding what you wanted in your own backyard. According to Littlefield, the march of Dorothy and her friends to the Emerald City to petition the Wizard of Oz for help was patterned after the 1894 march from Ohio to Washington of an industrial army led by Jacob Coxey, using Congress to return the system of debt-free government-issued greenbacks initiated by the great Abraham Lincoln. The march of Coxey's army on Washington began a long tradition of people taking to the streets in peaceful protests when there seemed no other way to voice their appeals. As Lawrence Goodwin, author of The Populist Movement, described the 19th century movement to change the money system, I quote, "There was once a time in history when people acted. Farmers were trapped in debt. They were the most oppressed of Americans. They experimented with cooperative purchasing and marketing. They tried to find their own way out of the stranglehold of debt to merchants, but none of this could work if they couldn't get capital. So they had to turn to politics, and they had to organize themselves into a party. The populists didn't just organize a political party, they made a movement. They had picnics and parties and newsletters and classes and courses, and they taught themselves and they taught each other, and they became a group of people with a sense of purpose, a group of people with courage, a group of people with dignity." Like the populists, Dorothy and her troop discovered that they had the power to solve their own problems and achieve their own dreams. The Scarecrow, if we remember, in search of a brain, the Tin Man in search of a heart, the Lion in search of courage, actually had what they wanted all along. When the Wizard's false magic proved powerless, the Wicked Witch was vanquished by a defenseless young girl and her little dog. When the Wizard disappeared in his hot air balloon, the unlettered Scarecrow took over as the leader of Oz. The Wizard of Oz came to embody the American dream and the American national spirit. In the United States, the land of abundance, all you had to do was to realize your potential and manifest it. That was one of the tale's morals, but it also contained a darker one, a message for which its imagery has become a popular metaphor, that there are invisible puppeteers pulling the strings of the puppets we see on the stage in a show that is largely illusion. So we'll start a little bit on the march to Washington that inspired in the book, The March on Oz. The 1890s were plagued by an economic depression that was nearly as severe as the Great Depression of the 1930s. Sound familiar? The farmers lived like serfs to the bankers, having mortgaged their farms, their equipment, and sometimes even the seeds they needed for planting. Does anything ever change under the sun here? They were charged with so much by a railroad cartel for shipping their products to the market that they could have more costs and debts than profits. The farmers were as ignorant as the Scarecrow of banking policies, while in the cities, unemployed factory workers were as frozen as the Tin Woodman from the lack of a free-flowing supply of money to oil the wheels of industry. The crime rate soared, families were torn apart, racial tensions boiled. 1890s, the nation was in chaos. Radical party politics thrived. In every presidential election between 1872 and 1896, there was a third national party running on a platform of financial reform. Typically organized under the auspices of labor or farmer organizations, these were parties of the people rather than the banks. They included the Populist Party, the Greenback and the Greenback Labor Parties, the Labor Reform Party, the Anti-Monopolist Party, and the Union Labor Party. What they advocated was expanding the national currency to meet the needs of trade, reform of the banking system, and democratic control of the financial system. Money reform advocates today tend to argue that the solution to the country's financial woes is to return to the gold standard, which required that paper money be backed by a certain weight of gold bullion. And the last point for today, to the farmers and laborers who were suffering under its yoke in the 1890s, the gold standard was the problem. Tune in next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.